dope, I said, bim bop. Skittle dope, I said, bim. Skittle dope, I said, skid out and bop. Skittle dope, I said, bim bop, boom.
This is the Freshman 15.
My name's Jeremy Bear, and whatever device you're listening to this podcast on will self-destruct in 1 second. No, just kidding. Your device is fine.
My name's Daniel Long, and Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall.
All right, Daniel, a lot to talk about this time. You want to just get into it?
Let's do it, man.
All right.
Now, we don't even know what this thing is. And you're talking about handing it over to a guy who provides terrorism with information.
Of course, I'm not suggesting that we just hand it over. We're going to tag the rabbit's foot so we can trace it and know where it is. Now, you know we can get that gear here. I just deliver it myself. We contact Musgrave, have the IMF trace a tag, order a raid, get the rabbit's foot back, grab Davian. Now, if I get out with Julia, we win. If I don't, then she's dead anyway. And so am I. God damn it. It's 8:11. It's 8:12. And we have 2 hours before they kill my wife. Are you in or not?
Of course we're in.
So Daniel, summer blockbuster part two.
Here we go, episode 26.
I mean, is anyone surprised that this is our pick for our next chapter in our summer blockbuster series?
I don't think so. I mean, they shouldn't be. This is when we talk about this director, we're talking about blockbuster films.
Even though our man JJ, and we're talking about JJ Abrams, his freshman film, Mission Impossible 3.
What a place to start.
What a place to start. When you track the trajectory of his feature film career, which is not exactly long, but it started kind of at the top and it continued at the top. I mean, there is really, I don't know. I mean, is there a bigger blockbuster director? Maybe kind of, but not really.
And here's a director who is not only a blockbuster director, he begins in a franchise of blockbuster films.
Right. And in among other blockbuster directors. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the Mission Impossible franchise, the whole thing started out with De Palma.
Yeah.
And then from there goes on to John Woo.
With the doves.
Of course. And whatever you might think of Mission Impossible 2, John Woo, I mean, you know, there's quite a bit of street cred there.
I know, of course. And here's a guy who goes to make a film, Mission Impossible 2. He had a string of films, right?
Right.
That he was successful in, made this one. And I wonder if people after Mission Impossible 2 were like, is this the last Mission Impossible movie?
There was a break in there. Now it was like a 6-year break. You know, a lot of people were starting to question, and I don't know if you remember this, it was long rumored that the director of the eventual Mission Impossible 3 for quite a while was actually going to be David Fincher.
I see. I didn't know this.
Yeah. I remember hearing that and being like, oh my gosh. I mean, you know, the whole idea was just mind blowing. Mixed feelings, admittedly.
That's because what I was going to ask you. So you were kind of like, I don't know how I feel about this, or were you pretty excited?
I mean, I was more excited than cynical because it's Fincher, and I know, well, it's Fincher, it's going to be good. But at the same time, I'm like, I can't really picture that, but I don't know, let's give it a shot. It sounds cool. Of course, that was in development hell forever, and Tom Cruise, who was, of course, the poobah of the Mission Impossible franchise, eventually just had to move on. Partly bring up Fincher because I think you're going to see some similarities between our David Fincher episode and our J.J. Abrams episode.
So do you think at this point people should go back and listen to the Fincher episodes?
I think people should go back and listen to our catalog no matter who they are.
That's what I was hoping you were going to say. So, you know, you said that before we were going to be recording. You said... You told me about the potential connections, and
you're dying to know.
I'm so intrigued by...
It's not as deep as you're probably thinking. Honestly, what it is much like the David Fincher episode. I see a director I love and a criminally underappreciated freshman film. To me, that's the biggest connection. I love J.J. Abrams to an unreasonable degree.
So you're admitting that it's unreasonable?
It probably is, because I don't think I've met someone who loves J.J. Abrams as much as I do. He's, when you're talking about summer blockbuster franchise, popcorn, action, virtuoso directors, J.J. Abrams across the board, 100%. He's my guy. He's my guy.
This is it.
Yeah, this is it. I've been wanting to do this episode for quite a while.
Really?
Oh, way back into season one, I was almost embarrassed to bring it up. Can I be honest?
Oh, yeah, of course.
When we sort of were discussing the idea of doing summer blockbuster directors, it was always my hidden agenda. I'm like, maybe that's a way I can kind of, I can get JJ in there.
So you didn't feel like we could talk about him in any other way except for within the blockbuster sort of theme?
I guess maybe I thought that I would get judged.
I think rightly so, because we did have a guest in our last episode, and we did bring it up to him that we were going to be talking about J.J. Abrams and Mission Impossible 3, and he's like, oh, God.
Yeah. I think that here's what I generally hear about Mission Impossible 3. People vary from, oh, yeah, to, yeah, that one was kind of, yeah. No one is like way, way down on it, but it's rare that I hear anyone that is like really super, super excited about it either. And this is why I get kind of embarrassed because, and again, you'll just have to forgive me.
No, just do it.
It's potentially my favorite action film.
Wait a second.
Mission Impossible 3.
So I'm excited that you said that because I talked to somebody before coming here to record. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, what movie? And I was like, I can't tell you. And he said, oh, come on.
Yeah, like this is going to like affect the Dow.
Right. And I said, okay, we're going to do Mission Impossible 3, J.J. Abrams. And he's like, oh, okay. Haven't seen it, not going to see it.
Yeah, there it is.
So we have a job to do tonight.
The evangelist. And here's the thing, Daniel. I don't want you to feel any pressure to edit your own opinions or something like that. I'm completely okay with the fact that I'm more into Mission Impossible 3 than anyone I've ever met. I've made peace with it.
So here's what I'm excited about, sort of thinking about this conversation and how it can go. So I, for whatever reason, have a general fondness for Mission Impossible films. Mm. Randy Baranowski, we talked about him.
Our original sound supervisor.
So we like Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah.
And when they come out, we try to make it a point to go see them together.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually think the Mission Impossible 3 is where that sort of started.
Oh, good. All right. We'll do our usual. So because it's such a big, fiery mystery, what's the premise of Mission Impossible 3?
I want you to do it.
You want me to?
I think you kind of want to. I can see it.
I will accept the mission.
Yeah, of course you will.
All right. So Mission Impossible 3, clearly this is coming off of Mission Impossibles 1 and 2, in which the central character of the IMF, the Impossible Mission Force, Ethan Hunt, played by Tom Cruise.
Of course.
He's back at it again. And in this case, of course, it is a globe-spanning adventure in which, for the first time, we find out a little bit about Ethan Hunt's personal life, specifically this girl that he's engaged to and all that. And you get the sense that he's kind of trying to get out of the game a little bit. But of course, he's pulled back in when an agent that he's trained has been captured and he needs to lead a team to go in and rescue this agent. And that leads into a whole bunch of international intrigue. You have a character named Owen Davian, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's maybe the evilest of all the Mission Impossible villains.
Easily.
Owen Davian is captured by Ethan. Ethan is captured by Owen Davian. There's a fiance / wife who's kidnapped and held ransom and all that. And so through it all, Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise, has to lead his small merry band of IMF agents to save the world once again.
Nice work.
And that's it. That's the whole thing. So, first question, Daniel, Mission Impossible 3. Now, you've already talked about it a little bit. First time you saw it, I'm guessing it was in the theater.
Yep. So that was 2006. My friend Randy and I were like, well, Mission Impossible is coming out. There's a soft spot in my heart for Tom Cruise movies. And
can I stop you for just a second?
Absolutely.
Because this is something that I don't want to go unsaid. I was having a film discussion, and this film discussion is at this point, it's over 10 years old. It may be nearly 15 years old.
With like a similar person or the same person?
A person who was interested in film, certainly not of your caliber, okay. But we were talking about Tom Cruise because I also love Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I love Tom Cruise.
I can't help it.
Yeah, it's just, I think he's great. I mean, everyone starts talking about Scientology and couch jumping, everything. I'm like, you know what? Just cool your jets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tom Cruise is the definition of a great American movie star. He's great. Here's what I love so much about Tom Cruise. If you look through his catalog, his hits to miss ratio, I think, is better than any other actor you can name.
I think that's right. And there's something about him people talk about when he was first came on the scene, where right. there's just this connection mm-hmm. that you have.
Now, with a couple of very minor exceptions, and I mean, these are very minor, and I don't think you can say this about almost any actor, but he doesn't make bad movies. Now, you can say that there's movies that are like, well, that wasn't my favorite and that wasn't my favorite. Okay.
Right.
Was it a bad movie, though? If you talk about what bad movies has Tom Cruise made, honestly, you could maybe count them on one hand.
Maybe, right.
Maybe. It's so rare to leave a Tom Cruise movie and going, eh, it was just bad.
No, but, and that's the thing about Tom Cruise movies. So, and I don't know what it is, and I'm guilty as charged in terms of my Tom Cruise affection.
Because yeah.
I think of even a film like Jack Reacher.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Why would I want to watch that? But I do.
But you do.
And I'm not even ashamed to admit that, yeah. right? And so with the Mission Impossible movies, I was sold. I was in. So in 2006, it was just a no-brainer. I was going to go see this movie.
Right.
When I saw it then, I remember walking up thinking, whoa, mm-hmm. that was so good.
Yeah.
Especially in reference to what came before.
Sure.
Right? In Mission Impossible 2.
Mission Impossible 2, which is, I would say, on the short list of bad Tom Cruise movies.
Right.
But again, so very few of them. But yeah, same. I saw Mission Impossible 3 in the theater. It's with my wife, J.J. Abrams, who at that point everyone knew was... Maybe some people knew him from Alias or something, but he was the guy who created Lost.
Yeah, that's how I remember him.
They gave him a budget to make a big Mission Impossible franchise blockbuster film. At the time, and I don't know if you remember this, may still be true, actually, for all I know. I don't know. I'll have to double check this. The biggest budget a freshman film director had ever received.
Whoa.
Ever.
For real.
And that may still be the case, actually. Yeah, no freshman. And I remember that was a news story at the time. No first-time director had ever received as much money as JJ did to make their first film.
Okay, so I think this is important to maybe pause here, think about and talk about JJ's career up to now.
Right.
People know that he was connected to and certainly had a big part to play in Lost.
Sure.
But I mean, let's go back to Felicity.
Right.
And television. And then Alias. I mean, that's right. like one of the things that he was known for at the time as a big show. And then Lost. So here you are, a first-time filmmaker getting this massive budget. Mm-hmm. Because, as you've already said in reference to Tom Cruise, here's a director whose movies are just, and shows and work, mm-hmm. is just successful.
Yeah, it was so interesting with J.J. Abrams. From the start, he had the sort of finger on the pulse quality. He knew what people liked to see and the way people liked to watch, particularly television, but not just television. He just had this kind of preternatural sense for what would go over really well with people. And it's very, very difficult to become a name creator of mm-hmm. TV shows. But he was able to do it. He had a name. People recognized that name. J.J. Abrams was almost immediately associated with this sort of quality product. And it's not like Mission Impossible was his first exposure to feature films. You know, he was, you know, coming off our Michael Bay episode, he was one of the writers of Armageddon. Mm-hmm. He knew how to create something that would appeal to a mass audience. But from the beginning, J.J. Abrams sort of had this kind of, I don't know how else to put it, this very unassuming, easygoing, laid-back attitude about the whole thing. Extremely unpretentious in his whole vibe and all that. But yet, he's just kind of one of those guys like, oh my gosh, if you knew how good you were, you would be insufferable. But he never comes across that way. And even, you know, with all of his recent success, he just always comes across like a regular dude, even though he's able to create these things in this way and able to pace these films and these stories and sort of unbox these mysteries for his audience in a way that just makes his audiences come back again and again and again.
You know, this reminds me of something that I'd read about. He tells a story about talking with his father about wanting to go to school to learn how to make movies. And his father says something, and I could be getting it wrong. It's better to learn the types of stories you want to tell than it is to learn how to make a movie. Live life and discover the things you actually want to make movies about,
right,
instead of focusing on how to make those movies. And I think that connects to what you were just saying about J.J. Abrams, here's a guy who's unpretentious. His imagination is kind of like off the charts in terms of what he's able to think up and what he's able to do and what the stories he wants to tell. And he's going to find a way to do that. in contrast to perhaps like a James Cameron of, oh, I want to do this type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, man, this is kind of what's going on in my head. I want to put this on the screen somehow.
Right. Yeah. I think it's in perfect contrast to like a James Cameron who seems to bask in the self-congratulating attitude. Anyway, I don't want to veer too far from specifically talking about the film that we're here to talk about. But it's so interesting when you take the situation, which in itself is kind of a Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise had seen the name J.J. Abrams because he had seen Alias.
And he loved it.
And Tom Cruise took a look at Alias and thought, if I could inject that kind of energy and intelligence and spark into the Mission Impossible franchise, I'm going to have a hit.
When I saw Alias, what you accomplished with Alias in one show, extraordinary.
Well, thank you.
It's great characters, great storytelling, incredible tension. That's what I wanted. That's what you do. That's what you're a great filmmaker.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
You're a great filmmaker.
So, for all practical purposes, Tom Cruise and longtime producing partner Paula Wagner, you know, they decide what they want to do and they decide how they want to do it. And they hire the right director that they think is going to get them there. In pretty much every case, like I said, was not a fan of the John Woo one, but in pretty much every case, as far as Mission Impossible goes, they've nailed it.
It seems like every time.
They've picked the right guys. It shouldn't be left unsaid that from JJ, you know, they moved on to Brad Bird,
mm-hmm.
did a fantastic one. From there, Christopher McQuarrie, mm-hmm. who's worked together with on Jack Reacher. And McQuarrie, of course, is going to be the first repeat offender yep. On the Mission Impossible franchise, which comes out, what, in like 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks, Fallout.
Yeah. So anyway, big deal. So they've struck gold. But for J.J. Abrams in 2006, it's kind of a Mission Impossible mm-hmm. because, you know, he's a completely unproven feature film director, even though he's clearly a really dynamic creator. But he had to go in and figure all this out. How do I run this story and how do I figure this out in such a way so that I don't break the franchise, or at least, I guess, according to some, and I'd be one of them, how do I unbreak this franchise that clearly had kind of a nasty bump in the road, you know?
And I just want to pause again, and I know you've already said it, but I just want it to sink into listeners' heads as it's sinking into mine. He has not directed a feature film yet.
Mm-hmm.
He's following Brian De Palma.
Right.
John Woo.
Yeah.
And here he is in his first ever effort stepping into this massive thing.
Right.
I know you've said it, but I just feel like I want people to recognize this shouldn't have happened.
Exactly. Most expensive freshman film of all time. And how's he going to do with it? So Mission Impossible 3 starts off with a scene. Now,
yes.
This is going to sound overstating, and I realize this is probably going to be a night of overstating because I just, you know, I love the movie probably more than I should. The opening 5 minutes of Mission Impossible 3 are maybe my favorite opening 5 minutes of any film I've ever seen in
Come
my
on.
Life. I'm not kidding.
For real.
It's the perfect opening. I've never seen a more perfect opening to a movie than the opening scene of Mission Impossible 3.
Oh, come. Really?
I'm not kidding, man. I've never been so amped to see the rest of the movie
right.
as I was after I saw that the first scene of Mission Impossible
3.
I mean,
3. I give it to you. There is something about those first few minutes that is unlike actually anything that had come before that, Mission Impossible-wise.
Right, yeah.
Because you don't do that.
You don't do that. You don't, you know, he did a Christopher Nolan. He said, I'm going to take the first scene of the third act of this film
yep.
and I'm going to make it the first scene of the first act of the film. And he just straight up repeats the scene later,
to
remind us, by the way, remember that scene you saw? Here it is again. And you don't care because it's such an amazing scene. It's the, you know, whatever, I call it the Shakespearean thing where it's like, how does he begin Romeo and Juliet? Just so you know,
right.
Two young people, they're going to fall in love and they're going to kill themselves at the end. So here's the story. He tells you the ending up front, basically, and that's what JJ does. And that takes such confidence as a director. I'm going to start with not the ending, but I'm going to start with the beginning of the climax.
Yeah, you know? And it does change. I mean, that's one of the things that I love about the movie. And JJ, I think, the whole idea of structure. I'm just going back to this. The first 5 minutes of any film.
I mean, Daniel, I know that sounds like a big statement, but I can't think of a film that has a better opening than Mission Impossible 3.
Wow. Magnolia?
It's another great one. I would put it up there with it, yeah.
Yeah, wow. What's amazing about it, though, is how it brought me back to how I remember actually experiencing it. Like the intrigue and the tension, the feelings, right? The thing that it does that no other Mission Impossible had done up until then is that Ethan Hunt is vulnerable.
And broken. Yeah. Nothing he tries works.
No.
And we've never seen Ethan Hunt in that position before. And that's what's so beautiful about it. And I don't mean to keep talking around and around it. For those who haven't seen it, the movie opens with Owen Davian holding Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise's new bride, hostage, and saying, you need to tell me where this rabbit's foot, which is, you know, which is this ambiguous, well, actually, we never find out what the rabbit's MacGuffin. Foot is. Yeah, it's the MacGuffin. Tell me where this rabbit's foot MacGuffin is, or I'm going to kill your wife. And he has a gun against her head. He says, I'm going to give you to the count of 10.
Jules, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Do you understand?
One.
You listen to me. I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else? If there was a misunderstanding, I will fix it. I can get it. Whatever you want.
Two.
Let's just, and I love that it's 10.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that I don't think I recognize, like, just what it does to the scene. Because you have the cliche of 3, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to count to 3. But there's something that counting to 10 does to the scene and to the different movements of that scene that is, I think, really pretty genius.
And with each number, Tom Cruise tries something different. He starts with sincerity. Well, wait, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Blah, blah, blah. He bounces to so many different tactics. The cool customer, the badass, the chess player, the angry guy, the scream, I'm going to kill you, let's talk like gentlemen, all that. All these different tactics. And of course, you know, the final tactic is just begging and pleading. And of course, that proves to be as effective as all the others, which is to say, not at all.
Please, don't do this. Just let it go. I promise you. I can figure out how to get whatever you
want. 9!
Listen to me. I want to help you. I want to help you get whatever you want. But you got to do what's right. What you know is right. No. No.
It's just such a beautifully done scene. You need the greatest American acting movie star
to do it.
to pull it off. You have to have Tom Cruise to do it. And I realize he's best known now for jumping off the sides of buildings and hanging onto planes and all this kind of stuff. We forget that Tom Cruise was also the guy from Magnolia. And we forget that he was the guy in the courtroom in A Few Good Men.
And Rain Man.
And all these incredible performances that Tom Cruise has given over the years that are just, that they're acting movies, not action blockbuster, you know, popcorn banana films. Just Tom Cruise is an actor. And I think he's able to show that here. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. The movie begins with this clear power differential, right, between Davian and Hunt.
Right.
Sets up the movie in a way that is awesome. Because you're wondering, oh, how's it going to get here? And you especially wonder that because there are clear power differentials where Hunt is the one in power and Davian is the one who's vulnerable.
Right.
Davian was kidnapped. Hunt had him. It's clearly he's the one in power. For all intents and purposes, it looks like Hunt is about to just let him go out of the bottom of a plane.
Right, he's about to drop him out of a plane when he won't give him the information that he needs.
And you're like, wait, how does Hunt and Davian get from this point to what you've already know will be at some point.
Yeah. Knowing that that power shift is going to happen in advance makes it actually even crazier.
Yeah. And that Abrams, and I think that's kind of one kind of thinking about what he is good at doing. Yeah. You know, here he is, he's a creator, right? He knows how to like infuse a story with, and I mean, he's famous for this, right? I think he had a TED talk or something about the mystery box.
Yeah.
He bought this mystery box decades ago and he's never opened it.
Right.
And it became a symbol of basically like, what's inside is never going to be as great as what he thinks could be there.
Now, I was looking at this, it was in my office, and it, as it always is on the shelf, and I was thinking, why have I not opened this? I find myself drawn to infinite possibility and that sense of potential, and I realize that mystery is the catalyst for imagination. Now, it's not the most groundbreaking idea, but when I started to think that maybe there are times when mystery is more important than knowledge, I started getting interested in this.
You're cheating your audience when you tell them everything.
Yeah, and I think that that's how he starts this movie.
Right.
And that's how we move through it as an audience, is we don't know the things that are going to happen. We're constantly wondering, how is this going to add up to that?
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think is one of J.J. Abrams' great strengths. He operates a story in such a way that he decides in advance what's going to be important to his audience and what's not going to be important. And he doesn't bother with the things that aren't important. That might seem like just a simple thing. Well, of course, that's what great stories do. They, you know, you major on the majors and you don't bother with the minors, and that's how you keep people entertained. But in real life, that's really hard. In fact, it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. When you're creating something you don't know. And that's the thing that's really, really hard for creators to impress on people who maybe don't spend as much of their time creating, or, you know, for artists to impress upon non-artists. You don't know what's going to be a hit. You don't know what's going to offend people. You don't know what's going to, you just don't know. And in hindsight, everything seems obvious. Well, of course you can't say that. That's offensive, you know? But at the time, it's like, I don't know. This is a gamble. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? And J.J. Abrams has this almost supernatural ability to know in advance what's going to be important and what's not going to be important to audiences. For example, as we were talking about earlier, the rabbit's foot.
Mm-hmm.
What is this thing?
Right.
Now, there's a moment that, you know, Simon Pegg, he gives a little mini monologue about, well, you know what, I kind of think maybe something like this is probably some doomsday Armageddon-style weapon that could, and he goes off on this whole theory about what it could be.
You see, it was inevitable that a compound would be created, which he referred to as the anti-god. It was like an accelerated mutator, a sort of, you know, like an unstoppable force of destructive power that would just lay waste to everything, to buildings and parks and streets and children and ice cream parlors, you know?
It's enough to get you to think, oh, this thing is probably dangerous, but we don't really know. When we get to the end of the movie, and we still don't know. It's just this kind of canister that has some really ominous-looking labels on it. We don't know what it is. But J.J. Abrams is saying, yeah, but you know enough.
Mm-hmm.
You're not here to find out the details of the rabbit's foot. You're here to find out what the IMF team is going to do and the ridiculous lengths that they're going to go and the sacrifices they're willing to make and the technologies they're going to use. J.J. Abrams is just, like I said, it's such an incredible ability to understand how to major on the majors and minor on the minors. There's nobody better.
I agree. I mean, in terms of telling a story that I think captivates audiences, I just think it's undeniable. One could argue I don't like his movies. Okay, that's fine.
Sure.
But to say that he doesn't make good movies, I mean, would be a stupid claim. You know, Abrams is one of those places, almost like a Nolan, where there's like this connecting point. But I was struck with, it was hard for me sometimes to locate the intentionality of the camera work and what he was doing. You're more attuned to that than I am. Do you see intentionality in his camera work in Mission Impossible 3? Because I was wondering, I can tell he has a lot of movement. I feel like that's characteristic of an Abrams film, right? Right. And it doesn't seem as happenstance as a Michael Bay. Mm-hmm. We talked about that in our last episode. Yeah. But I was wondering, like, it's hard for me to locate meaning in what he's doing with the camera. But I'm wondering if, you know, if you can.
Yeah, I think J.J. Abrams is very intentional. And I think that is the difference between J.J. Abrams and Michael Bay. Michael Bay knows how he wants you to feel. And that's tense and stressed, amped up. But I think that feeling in and of itself is the goal for Michael Bay.
Got it.
It's like, I just, if I can stress you out and make you feel tense and all that, and I can translate that into just this sort of action-y vibe, then I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I fulfilled my purpose here. J.J. Abrams, I think, knows how to do those things, but he says it has to be in service to something, though.
Got it.
If I'm making you tense, I need to do something with that tension later.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm making you like this character, it's because I need to do something with that later. Nothing's really wasted. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so amazing to me about J.J. Abrams. He's also a very economical storyteller. He doesn't waste a beat. He doesn't waste a line. Every single moment is in service of something. Mission Impossible 3, again, I don't know anyone who agrees with me on this. It's easily the best of the Mission Impossible movies. I think it outshines all of them. And that's really saying something. There's not one single wasted beat. Just, it never stops moving.
That's right. I think you're right. Yeah.
All action movies need exposition.
Yes.
It's just, even if it's just a tiny little bit, what JJ is able to do with this story is he makes the action the exposition, which is amazing and hard to do. We all have to have those scenes in our movies where we're like, well,
right,
the president of Bulgaria has declared that blah, blah, blah. And you have to have those scenes or else it's like, okay, well, you know, it's, we have to know what we're fighting for and who we're fighting against and set the rules of the movie up for your audience. The thing that's so great about J.J. Abrams, particularly in this film, instead of having people in rooms staring at each other and talking, you know, with projection screens behind them, mm-hmm, or something like that, he takes the context of cool shit and he works the exposition into that. So you don't just have Tom Cruise on a phone call saying, I have a really good idea about attaching a winch to the top of a right building and then base jumping off of it and using that as a fulcrum to, you know, it's just you're already mid tension and you see him, you know, taking like a grease pencil and drawing on the side of a, yes, of a window and all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, there's all these other tense things happening all at the same time. And he's just like, if I've got to do an exposition, I'm going to make it look cool as hell. And I'm going to do this and this and this. And it's all going to have a story purpose.
How tall is that building?
Why?
It's 162 meters, the highest point.
What about that? The building on the left, how tall is that one?
It says 226 meters.
226. Distance between the buildings?
47.55 meters across.
That's good. I think it's tall enough.
For what? A fulcrum.
He knows that he's not giving us a break.
No.
And he almost makes a joke of that at one point in the movie, which it's actually one of my favorite parts. There's a moment where Tom Cruise, he's dressed up as Owen Davian, mm-hmm, so he has his Philip Seymour Hoffman mask and makeup, and it's clearly Philip Seymour Hoffman, mm-hmm, just acting. It's, you know, we all know it's Ethan Hunt in disguise. He pops his head up out of a manhole,
yep,
and he's about to get his team out of the Lamborghini, mm-hmm, down into the manhole. But there's a moment that he shares with Ving Rhames. He just says, what's up?
What's up?
Nothing. What's up with you?
Nothing.
And it's just like, it, at the time, it feels just like a funny throwaway line. For me, it's actually one of the most important moments in the movie because it's J.J. Abrams taking a moment to sympathize with his audience, mm, and being like, I know this thing is crazy and I know that this is nonstop and I know that this has been nonstop adrenaline and all that. I want to take just a beat to let you catch your breath and let you know that I understand how you feel.
Yeah.
And so he does that for literally about 5 seconds, and then it's back to the action and all that. It's such an important beat in the movie because it's a level-setting beat for us. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder of how seriously we should be taking all of this, which is not very. And it's also a reminder of who these characters are, the relationship between them, everything that's happened before, everything that's about to happen, the nature of IMF and all that. In these few little lines, he's accomplished all this narrative and they feel like throwaway lines. That's the genius, in my opinion, of J.J. Abrams. I know you were asking about camera work, but I kind of got off on a tangent.
I love it because it connects, I think, with one of the things that he also does later, the fulcrum scene, right? And, yeah, and how that could possibly be the scene with the most exposition, and yet you could never be prepared for what's about to happen.
Right.
Right. And I love that. He's coming up with the idea, and even Ving Rhames is like, oh, a fulcrum.
Right.
And even in your head, you're thinking, okay, I kind of know, I have an idea of what that means. And,
yeah.
Okay, but I don't know how that would, conceptually, what's that going to look like?
Right.
All of that happens, and it's wonderful. I mean, the rabbit's foot is so important. And yet you never know. And it's so hard to get into this building. And you're never in the building.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, another moment where he does that, where you become with the characters waiting for, yeah, Ethan, right?
Yeah.
And you take a break. You have this really interesting interaction with the other IMF agents, yeah, in, who are waiting for Ethan.
The Buddhist prayer.
What is that?
When I was little, I had a cat. He used to run away all the time. It was just a prayer I'd say to bring him home.
Teach it to me.
I've got the rabbit's foot, but I can't make it to the roof.
What the hell do you mean you can't make it to the roof? Where are you?
Look up!
And then all of a sudden, it's just boom.
Yeah.
Right, it just happens again. He's jumping out of a window onto the truck, and there you go.
It's so much better than if we'd seen Ethan Hunt running through that building, in my opinion. It was perfectly played.
Because you've already seen that.
Yeah. We know what Ethan Hunt looks like when he's running around and shooting people and running away with, like, a device. We've seen that for the last two movies. We know what that looks like. We've already seen him sort of do that in the first half of this movie. He gave us a moment that was better. Because we needed an outside perspective just for a moment on the Ethan Hunt story, and we got one. Who is Ethan Hunt to these people? We get the moment to experience that, and I don't know how he does it, but JJ understands that in that moment, we need that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're kind of at this point in our discussion where we're talking about things that maybe connect to other films. And, you know, one of the things I notice in this film that I see all throughout of his work, I love the color palette that he chooses to use. I mean, it's the bright, vibrant colors. It does something that I'm sure you could explain better. It feels cinematic.
Right.
It doesn't feel muted.
Right. It's very crisp.
It's very crisp and really beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course, we're going to talk about it, and I want to hear you talk about it. What am I going to say? The thing that he uses, the lens flare.
The lens flare.
Right? I mean, so, and I feel like that's connected to
JJ's greatest sin.
And I think that's connected to the crispness.
Right.
It comes with the brightness of the colors. But he gets a lot of shit for it.
Yeah, the lens flare, you know, there's a syndrome that all people who create for a living are familiar with. I call it the Google logo syndrome. So a few years back, Google revamped their logo. Everyone went apeshit.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in the world, especially people who don't design logos for a living, had 1,000 comments about why this is the worst logo they've ever seen. It's barely different. If anything, it's uglier. Look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this.
Yeah.
The biggest sin that the new Google logo committed was the fact that people weren't used to it.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. They start pointing to things that they can identify. Oh, I see what they're doing there. That means it's bad.
Uh-huh.
And if you're a creative professional, you see it happen all the time, and you see it happen with your own work. You have to push through it, and you have to say, you know what, I have to just believe in my own sense of aesthetic, and I just have to keep going, you know?
So then what you're saying is, when something's changed, they start to criticize what they're able to pinpoint without recognizing how that change is perhaps connected to the larger whole.
Or even without knowing how to assign a good, bad value to it,
okay.
They just know that they're uncomfortable, and they see that something is different, so they associate this thing that makes them uncomfortable with this thing that they can identify, and that makes that thing that they can identify bad.
Got it. So it's just like, it's all of a sudden, it's all completely thrown out.
Yeah. So just my opinion, this is what happens with J.J. Abrams lens flares. So in my opinion, it's not like J.J. Abrams was going so insane with the lens flares.
Agreed.
That, you know, you just, wow, I just, it's like, I can't even see anything. I can't even tell what's going on. Of course you can tell what's going on. But they see the lens flares and they see it as something that they can identify. And they think, oh, because I see it and I recognize it, it's something I can pinpoint, it must be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, frankly, you know, in the same way that 90-degree camera angles and stuff is part of the Wes Anderson aesthetic, you know, sort of desaturated greens and tans and stark lighting and stuff like that is part of the David Fincher aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on and on, pick whatever director you want. This very specific type of lens flare movement, which in some cases were practical lens flare, and in some cases wasn't. That was part of an aesthetic choice that J.J. Abrams was starting to build. People were able to identify it. That made it bad. That's oversimplifying. You know, it could be that people are looking at it and they generally have this visceral reaction. My theory is, though, that if this had never been pointed out to anyone, that he uses a lot of lens flares, I think it would have been fine. I don't think it affects anyone's aesthetic experience. In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I actually like the lens flares. I know that makes me sound like a freaking Philistine.
How dare you?
I like JJ's lens flares. And I'm not trying to say that he's never overused them. you know, recently in preparation for this, I watched Super 8. There were a couple of moments where I was like, okay, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of layers here. And it's, you know, especially with the flaring and all that. And maybe it was a little much here. Is it destroying my experience with Super 8? Good Lord, no. It's a great film.
I think you're right. And I read somebody who said, J.J. Abrams likes sparks. Like as if that's a trademark.
Yeah.
Right, to have sparks in this film.
Yeah, see every other action film in the world.
Exactly. But see, that's what happens. Somebody says that,
right,
and you watch the movie with gunfire or welding, in the case of Star Trek, right, as they're putting together the ship.
Yeah.
Or explosions, and you're like, oh, wow, he likes sparks.
Right.
Oh, and the director is all about that.
Right.
I go back. I already said it, but I love the colors in this film, and yeah. I just see the lens flares as actually part of that.
Yeah. You know, there's a designer. He's a motion designer. His name is Andrew Kramer, and he creates lens flares for all the big directors. He created a Michael Bay lens flare. He created a J.J. Abrams lens flare, and he lets those directors use them. So actually, a lot of these lens flares that J.J. Abrams, he doesn't really use them anymore because he got shamed out of it. But a lot of these...
lens flare shame.
It's true. A lot of these lens flares that J.J. used over the years were actually Andrew Kramer lens flares as part of the J.J. Abrams catalog that he created. J.J. Abrams isn't the only guy that he created lens flares for. Like I said, there's Michael Bay and there are others. But nobody gets more shit than J.J. Abrams. Part of my theory is, and admittedly this is a little biased...
Can't wait.
J.J. Abrams is such a flawless freaking filmmaker that everyone felt like they had to find something, and so they picked on his lens flares.
I love all this J.J. love.
I'm sorry. I realize this is just... To everyone who's just grossed out right now by all the J.J. love, I apologize. And yet I don't. He's my favorite action guy. You're not going to find a better director than J.J. Abrams. He's the best.
So, you know, so far, kind of our conversation... Like, I've brought up some of the things that I see that are characteristics of films that have lasted. I'm curious what you see as things that J.J. Abrams did here that he's continued to do.
Yeah. I think on paper, taking something like, let's see Ethan Hunt's home life, is kind of a bad idea.
Like, if that was somebody was going to pitch, here's a key plot point to the film.
Right.
Okay.
If I'm an exec for a studio... And someone says, you know, I've been thinking about it. Let's talk about Ethan Hunt's marriage. I'd be like, dude, come on.
People don't care.
No. And you can even see in subsequent Mission Impossible movies, they're trying to kind of brush that off. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like, okay, we can't completely ignore it. So, you know, we'll see.
Thanks, JJ.
That's how it feels a lot of ways. Right. Just like, okay, now we got to deal with this thing that JJ Abrams foisted on us. But I can't help it. I think it actually worked in this movie. I actually like it in this context. By the way, J.J. Abrams never intended on being the franchise guy. He's done 5 films, and with the exception of one, the one being Super 8, these are all enormous franchise films that he's done.
Freaking huge.
Enormous, as in the biggest franchise films there are. Star Trek, Star Wars, Mission Impossible. You don't get bigger.
No.
I think he does that, though. I think J.J. makes sure in every single one of his films that he does, he brings in, at the risk of it being to a fault, this sort of human element into something that I think on paper you would almost resist it being just like a, you know, it's just like, I don't really know that I did. Do I really need to see the childhood of Captain Kirk? Mm-hmm. I don't know that I really need to see this. And then you see it and you're like, damn it. It's it works, though. He made it work. I think that's one of his signature things. He's able to take this, I don't know how else to put it, on paper, bad idea because it overly humanizes these characters that are just meant to be popcorn characters. But JJ says, I need to get underneath that even more. In fact, he even brings that up in, like, you're talking about this mystery box TED Talk that he does. He spoke about Jaws, where he's like, it's not the shark that makes this thing this amazing movie. It's this scene, and he shows the scene, the son and the dad, and the moment. Give me a kiss.
Give us a kiss.
Why?
Because I need it.
That's what makes Jaws a great movie. Not the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, none of that. No, it's that. It's connecting to the humanity of these characters.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, I think that's what you get in this movie that you don't get before it. Ethan Hunt is a human being in The Force Awakens. I mean, all of those characters, right. Every single one of them. It might be the film where he takes the most time with the villains and the heroes to say, these are all people. Right. And what a film to do that in, a franchise where people could care less whether or not you have the enemy being people you can relate to.
Here's a movie where the pivotal scene is Han Solo trying to emotionally connect with his son.
Right.
Are you out of your freaking mind? I mean, I don't need to see that. And yet JJ takes me there.
Yeah.
And I'm destroyed at what happens to Han Solo.
It's too late.
No, it's not. Leave here with me. Come home.
I'm being torn apart. I know what I have to do, but I don't know if I have the strength to do it. Will you help me?
Yes, anything.
So kind of thinking about what you just said, then if you were to take the films after the J.J. Abrams films, Ghost Protocol, and then Rogue Nation, and then you have Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, those films that follow, even if they don't follow suit, are only strengthened.
They're richer.
They're richer by what Abrams did.
I think it's underappreciated what J.J. Abrams did, not just the fact that he contributed such investment in the life of Ethan Hunt for his audience, but I think it's also kind of forgotten that J.J. Abrams kind of rescued the franchise from the depths.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it was just Mission Impossible 2 was terrible. I think there were low expectations for Mission Impossible 3 because of that. And he completely turned the franchise around. And that was just the first of feature film franchises that he completely turned around. I mean, Star Trek.
I just didn't think that would be anything.
No, exactly. I mean, seriously, Star Trek, the original cast, the original crew, the original Star Trek, it was a stale thing for old nerds. Mm-hmm. And JJ took it and said, no, this is some of the freshest stuff you'll ever see. The biggest franchise turnaround, maybe of all time, has to be Star Wars The Force Awakens. And I realize I say that knowing that a lot of people had a lot of complaints with The Force Awakens. To me, it was the most pitch-perfect treatment of a franchise film I think maybe I've ever seen. It was so exactly right. If you stick too close to the original formula, which a lot of people, that was the complaint from a lot of people, then it's like, this is more stale than ever. If you deviate too much, then it's like, oh, well, he's just trying to do his own thing. And, you know, all the complaints that came along with The Last Jedi and all that kind of stuff. There's so many different ways you could have gone wrong. And J.J. Abrams was able to steer that ship into something that made Star Wars as exciting as it ever was. I think Star Wars The Force Awakens is actually a better movie than even Star Wars A New Hope.
It points to another one of his things that he's done, not in his television work and in his film work. He treats women characters with such respect.
Yeah.
They have actually some agency and power.
Yeah.
I mean, to think that in Mission Impossible 3, the person who saves the day at the end of that film is
Michelle Monaghan.
Yeah, Michelle Monaghan's character.
Yeah. And then, she's only one of several fantastic, Maggie Q, Carrie Russell. These are great characters.
Yeah, I mean, and you think of Alias, right?
Sure.
And you think of, I mean, The Force Awakens again. I mean, you have these strong female characters going back to what you said at the beginning of this episode of the connections to David Fincher. I mean, right. I see that too with the J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
So, Jeremy, I know we need to get into the things that don't work so well with this freshman film, but one question I have, is there a favorite moment in a J.J. Abrams film that you think about or that you just kind of go back to? It's like, man, I love that. Probably I'm setting this question up because I have one.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm curious if you have one.
Well, let me hear it.
Okay, so my favorite moment of a J.J. Abrams is the moment in Star Trek. They do the space jump onto the drill, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember being in the theater watching this scene and thinking, this is the power of cinema.
Yeah.
They're getting ready to jump, and they do jump, and it's nearly silent.
Right.
You hear them breathing, and you see like the close-ups of their faces kind of going through space.
Right.
And I just believed that's what it would be like.
It feels legitimate.
Oh my goodness.
Good luck.
And that's not even my favorite J.J. Abrams film, but right. That's certainly, I think, my favorite moment.
Yeah. It was funny, even when you asked the question, I had like seven of them pop into my mind immediately, and at least half were from Star Trek.
It's great.
I know you say it's not my favorite J.J. Abrams film. It is mine.
Well, you gave it away.
I'm sorry. Spoiler. Star Trek, I think it actually is his greatest film. That movie was so carefully treated. But yeah, also, you know, the silence of essentially the space massacre as Captain Kirk was being born right. At the beginning of the movie. It was just amazing. The Beastie Boys, while young Captain Kirk steals a car. There's so many things in that movie that are just such beautiful, beautiful moments. But, you know, if I'm being honest, I think as good as any of those, and I realize this is just me repeating myself, the opening of Mission Impossible 3.
There it is.
I mean, I just, it's just so great. He opens his films so well.
Yeah.
All of his films. But no, I mean, even the opening of Super 8, you just piece by piece, you see the truth of what happened in this boy's family. I mean, just these little J.J. Abrams moments that they shouldn't belong in this crazy sci-fi effects extravaganza that's, you know, a love letter to Steven Spielberg. But there they are, which is another thread. You know, J.J.'s probably the biggest Steven Spielberg fan in the world.
Right.
And that shouldn't go unnamed. But anyhow, I'm sorry. I realize you wanted one moment, but there's so many.
I love it. No, it's okay. And now for the hard part.
Yeah.
So what are the things in Mission Impossible 3 you don't think work so well?
That is hard because I have to get so nitpicky. If I'm being just a dick and I'm trying to be like, okay, what if I have to pick something?
Which is, I feel like sometimes the position I'm put in.
Yeah. Probably the least engaged I am in the movie is during the wedding scene, honestly. Mm-hmm. It does sort of grind things to a halt and, you know, so that they can have their whatever vending machine rings and all that kind of stuff, which I think is actually a very sweet scene. It's such a nitpick, though. I don't know. I even feel bad saying that. I just, for the most part, think everything in the movie works. I don't know. Do you have a least favorite?
That's actually where my mind went, is the scene on the roof, which is connected to the wedding scene, where I felt like J.J. Abrams had done such good work that I was already invested in their relationship. I didn't feel like I needed that.
Ethan, what's going on?
I need to ask you for something. It's the most... I need you to trust me.
Of course I trust you.
So I think it kind of verged on the sentimental, which I know they needed to get to the to the scene of the marriage. So I get all that. And I'm wondering if that's more testimony to J.J. Abrams' good work to feel invested in that relationship. But
yeah. There's so many little moments, and even just with some of the lesser characters and all that, I love the Lawrence Fishburne red herring. I think it's think it's great. I love that he's set up to be this guy, and you believe it.
Which you believe, yeah, yeah. I was going to say
I
that.
I bought it. Oh yeah, he must be the guy. I mean, that's just it's the rules of Mission Impossible. There's a mole. The mole?
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. And I love how even this movie treated that, which was spoiler, Billy Crudup. He's not an evil mole. He's actually kind of a decent guy who
wants an informant.
Yeah, and he's making manipulative, maybe ill-advised decisions. You know, and I actually kind of like the fact that Michelle Monaghan settles the moral question at the end by accidentally blowing Billy Crudup away.
For sure.
It's just freaking great. Everything gets brought back around. Lake Wanaka.
Yeah,
that's lip true. Reading, you know, I'm going to make her call out your name while I kill you in front of her and stuff. And just every single beat, no matter how minor, gets brought back around, even down to like the freaking whatever sinus bomb.
Yep.
Every setup has a payoff. And that's, I don't know, were there things that he left out later that he did here? Honestly, I don't know.
I don't know either. It seems like he's only built upon what he's been doing.
It's amazing how innovative he is with all of these franchise properties, because you can see that he clearly has nothing but deep, deep affection for all of them. You can tell he loves Star Wars and he loves Star Trek and he loves Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible. You can tell every frame of that film is evidence of how much he loves these properties.
Yeah.
and he treats them so well. And honestly, it pisses me off how much people shit on Star Trek Into Darkness, which I will defend as a fantastic film.
No, it's great.
I love that film.
Yeah, I don't understand all the hate for it.
I'm sorry, this is into spoiler territory, but we knew that Benedict Cumberbatch was going to be Khan. We knew it. Well, great. Good for you. You knew it. Wow, you guessed the big mystery before you even saw the movie. That's great. It's still a great movie.
Yeah, right. I appreciate your affection for J.J. Abrams because I do think that he's guilty because of the types of movies he makes, not because of how he makes them.
Right.
He's not just making action movies.
Yeah.
He's making movies that he feels are important, that are connected to, I think, history.
Yeah.
The love of filmmaking, and he wants to rethink or to revamp or to bring something of old to a newer generation. And I feel like that's admirable. I do think that there's, you know, we live in such ahistorical times where it's just, it doesn't matter what's come before.
Mm.
And JJ says, no, it does, actually.
Yeah.
It matters the types of movies that have come before this. One of the things I love about Mission Impossible 3, it's toward the beginning when Ethan is riding on the motorcycle.
Yeah.
I'm like, Top Gun.
Right.
I mean, that's just, either this seems like such a connection to history.
Right.
That I love.
And Mission Impossible 2, even.
Oh, true, right, with the motorcycle.
Well, sure. And it's, I feel like it's JJ saying, it would be easy for me to shit on things too, and I'm not going to do it. And I feel like, you know, Star Trek, he could have done the thing where he says, I'm going to get Chris Pine and Zach Quinto, and I'm just going to reboot the series. And that's it. Better effects, the whole thing. But he said, no, I don't really want to quite do that. I want those stories that came before mine to still count.
Mm-hmm.
I want Leonard Nimoy to be in my movie. And I want to come up with a way to respect what came before. I mean, clearly Star Wars, you know, it's just, it's all about not just, I want to, you know, showing respect to the original trilogy. Of course, everyone loves the original trilogy. But he also just gave just minor, very, very minor, saying, I'm not going to pretend that the prequels didn't happen either.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of my audience that actually liked these awful prequels.
Yeah.
I'm going to acknowledge them. He didn't have to do that. Well, maybe he did. I don't know. Kathleen Kennedy maybe mandated it. It's possible. He wants to acknowledge what came before it and build on that and say, I'm not here to make judgments about whatever other movies and whatever other happened in this franchise. I'm here to make the best of it and build on, for better or worse, to build on what's there. So I don't know. He's just such a stand-up guy, in my opinion. He's a stand-up creator. That's why it's so hard to answer these questions about, like, well, what's bad and what's, you know, he's just such a good dude.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Has this been an overgush on Mission Impossible 3? You can be honest.
I don't think it's been an overgush. I think people are always going to reconsider his films because of what they're connected to.
Right.
But as a filmmaker, as somebody who has a style and who has stories they want to tell, I think it's appropriate.
Mm.
So I think Mission Impossible 3 is near the top for me, but it's hard because I just like J.J. Abrams movies.
Yeah.
But the one I feel like most close to is Super 8, actually.
Yeah.
That's probably the J.J. Abrams movie I would watch more often.
Yeah. What a great cast in that film. The kids, holy
cow.
That's
the thing. I think I love that about the love, again, for film, for stories, even within the story. I mean, all that is just, I don't know, so good.
Yeah. You can't watch Super 8 cynically. It doesn't let you do it.
And I think that's probably why I'm most connected to it. I feel like we're sharing like a similar heartbeat, I feel like, when I'm watching that movie.
Yeah. I realize you're younger than I am, but just even remembering that time, remembering what it is to be a kid in that time, I totally get and appreciate and am part of all the love for Stranger Things on you know, the Netflix series. It's great. Super 8 did it better.
That's what I think. And first. And yeah.
Super 8 did it first and better. And that's really saying something, because Stranger Things is a great series.
It's great.
But Stranger Things is essentially Super 8, the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a beautiful story, and it's such a relatable story. I was that kid with his dad's camera marshaling my friends to try and make little movies when I was that age. You know, I remember being that kid and doing exactly that.
Positions. Ready. Start filming. Be extra loud when the train passes by. Here we go. And action.
John, I don't like it. This case, these murders.
What do you want me to do? Go to Michigan with you?
So you kind of already gave away what your top might be, but where do you rank Mission Impossible 3?
See, this is the thing that's so hard for me, because this top, by the way, Star Trek, that's barely nostrils above the skin of the water of the other things, because it's just they're all so good. Basically, I have a top that's just barely the top and a bottom that's just barely the bottom.
Got it.
And the barely the bottom is going to actually also going to be his other Star Trek movie, which is Into Darkness. Fantastic movie. Those middle three, Super 8, Mission Impossible 3, Star Wars The Force Awakens, I can't order those.
Mm-hmm.
They're all just near perfect movies that I love and I'll always love and I go back to constantly. I don't think J.J. Abrams has ever done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He's put himself in that spotlight to have that level of scrutiny, to be in charge of these sorts of properties, but he handles it.
He is a serious filmmaker who doesn't take himself too seriously in terms of the pretentiousness.
Yeah.
He respects the art. He respects the films.
Yeah. And one thing that I don't want to go unsaid, he has the talent of surrounding himself with amazingly talented people. I mean, just amazingly. I was watching, I think it was one of the Star Trek films the other night with my wife, and she said, "Who did the music for this?" And I said, "Well, I think it's Giacchino, who does all of JJ's films, well, with the exception of Star Wars." She's like, "Wow, it's just so good." And it's true, Giacchino. I mean, even, you know, whatever, back certainly from his TV days, he was scoring all of his stuff. He's among the best.
Yeah,
you know?
He's so good.
He's just so good. But JJ has surrounded himself with fantastic producers. DP, the actors certainly, writers. The fact that early on he hitched his star to Damon Lindelof and the concept even of Lost, which, you know, makes me sort of feel like our good friend Jeff Jensen should have been part of some of this discussion.
Woo-woo.
By the way, Jeff Jensen, maybe the biggest Lost fan there is in the world.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So shout out to Jeff, who we hope to have back on the show again soon. Anyhow, I feel like I've exhausted
the
patience of the audience with all my gushing, but
I don't know. I hope people go revisit Mission Impossible 3.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it is.
In terms of summer blockbuster popcorn fare, I don't personally think you're going to see a better movie.
I really don't.
Maybe even if you don't have any interest in the other Mission Impossibles, I think you're still going to love it. I really, really do. It's so solidly done. Everything about it, from the camera work to the acting to the direction to the story to the humanity to on down the line, it's just such a solid little caper. Mission Impossible 3, virtuoso director J.J. Abrams. Go check it out.
So thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to reach us, you can find us on Facebook or on Instagram. You can actually email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. Also, we'd love for you to take a moment to rate us on iTunes. It helps people find our podcast if they want to listen to it. So please go ahead and do that.
And you know what's coming. Daniel and I, favorite streaming media service, best in the world, Filmstruck. If you're interested in Criterion Collection films, classic films, Turner Classic Movies, all these fantastic directors of old, and also even a handful of contemporary directors, some of the greatest filmmakers of all time you can find on this streaming service. To call it bang for your buck is to way undersell it. A subscription to Filmstruck, well worth the dough. Go for it. We love it. We just don't hesitate to recommend it. Go check them out. So anyway, we're going to call that part two of our summer blockbuster series of three different blockbuster filmmakers. Began with Michael Bay, continued here with J.J. Abrams, and who is going to complete the triad? Who's our final blockbuster summer director? I don't know what to tell you.
Come back next time.
Stick around. I guess you'll find out. Anyhow, until next month, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. Skip the door, I said, let's get out and buy. Skip the door, I said, Bill.